When morning comes to Morgan Town, the merchants roll their awnings down, the milk trucks make their morning rounds.
And welcome to Health Talk. I can't believe it is the 2nd of March already, and Health Talk is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Compassionate Care, Garden Island Hydro, and Kauai Pharmacy.
Kevin Bako, MD of Hawaii Compassionate Care, offers medical marijuana certification exams at his office in Kapa'a. Information and appointments available at 808-854-6335 or online at HawaiiCompassionateCare.com.
Garden Island Hydro, assisting with all your growing needs. Nutrients, mediums, all-natural compost tea, lights, aquaponic and hydroponic components, systems, and setups. In the Puhi Industrial Park, Lihue. Family-owned and operated, open Monday through Saturday, 246-GROW, and online at GardenIslandHydro.com.
Kauai Pharmacy, an organic herbal tea farm in Kilauea, serving locally grown organic loose leaf herbal tea, raw extracts, and more. Kauai Pharmacy Tea Wagon at Na'ainaho Community Park, just outside of Kauai Mini Golf in Kilauea. Open Tuesday to Friday from 11 to 4 p.m. and Saturday from 9 to 1. 828-6525, kauaipharmacy.com. KauaiPharmacy.com.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. And I must say as well, the views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not represent those of KKCR, its board, its members, its underwriters, or its programmers. Good afternoon, Dr. Donna Kaplan and Dr. Yu. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cousin Randy.
Aloha. What a beautiful day, huh?
Oh, gorgeous, gorgeous.
Yeah. And your mom over there. Hi, Ray. How you doing? She's getting nice and tan. She's looking pretty good to head on back to the East Coast.
Yeah, she's to gonna Boston be, with she, all that snow. They're going to be in shock.
You're going to be the hit of the town with your tan.
That's right.
Well, welcome to Health Talk, the first and third Mondays of the month, 12 to 1 here at KKCR.
Wonderful. Well, so my parents are going to be leaving at the end of this week, so this is the last show that my dad, Dr. Hubert Kaplan, is going to be on the show with me, and it's been really wonderful having him on the show, and some of you have heard us together, but it's really a treat for me, and as I've said before in previous shows, I'm just very blessed to have him as a dad and a mentor. He's been practicing medicine for over 52 years, and his patients just absolutely love him and adore him because he really cares and spends the time, has incredible bedside manner, and also as well is a expert clinical and physical diagnostician. So thanks, Dad, for being on the show again and being who you are.
Thank you, Donna. It sounds like you're talking about yourself, not me.
And you just received an award this past year. Isn't that right, you?
Yes.
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 And what was that for?
That was from my state medical society, the Massachusetts Medical Society, for a distinguished service.
And you want to just, for those listeners who don't know you yet, you want to just give a little bio of who you are in terms of your professional bio?
Very short. I attended Harvard University and then graduated from Tufts Medical School and had my internship in the Boston area, went into the Army for a few years, and then came out and finished up my residency and special training in rheumatology, arthritis, and related diseases, and then joined the faculty at Tufts, and I'm currently a professor of medicine, and spent most of my career at the Newton Wellesley Hospital in Newton, Massachusetts, now inundated in snow.
Mm-hmm. Well, just we're going to have two topics, and I asked my dad, Dr. Hugh, to speak about a little bit about prostate and PSA, which is the screening, the current screening for cancer and prostate cancer. And just some of the issues about it. We were actually talking about it on the beach, and I thought, you know, that's a really great topic for the radio show, because a lot of people, a lot of men can come have high PSAs, and they get really worried, and it's not necessary. It can always be a false alarm. So we're going to start by talking a little bit about that. And then we're going to talk more about the medicine through the years and just the trends. But let's see, for callers, people who want to call in, let's wait about 15 or 20 minutes and then we can take callers. So let's talk about the PSA, prostate antigen test.
Okay, fairly quickly, PSA is the prostate-specific antigen. It was discovered a few years ago, and not only worrying patients, but it worries doctors a great deal, because it is used as a screening test for early detection of prostate cancer, but it also is very non-specific in the sense that things like enlargement that comes with age, infection, inflammation, mechanical, traumatic things like bicycle riding, motorcycle mm-hmm. riding, simply a rectal examination, sexual activity can elevate the prostate level, the PSA level, non-specifically. And because of the situation in this country, because I think we need to separate it out, because in other countries the tendency is just to watch an elevated prostate and not to make any moves medically until it begins to really elevate. Mm-hmm. And that's because we cannot, and this is the key, distinguish which prostate cancers are simply sitting there, especially in older men, and not causing any issues such as early death and whatnot, but which ones are, on the other hand, very aggressive and killer cancers. So that an elevated PSA, particularly one that accelerates over a year, doubles or triples its value, generally requires a biopsy, which is not an easy procedure. There are complications. And if the biopsies, and ordinarily they'll take maybe 8, 10, or 12 or more samples, if any one of them shows a little grouping of cancer cells, the next step is, in this country generally, radical surgery. If the patient, however, is unable to tolerate it by virtue of age or other conditions such as heart, they are then given radiation treatment. But if we look at men who, let's say, in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and who pass on for other reasons, heart attacks, strokes, and whatnot, there's very, very often cancer of the prostate just sitting there. And so the point is that they die of other things. Well, a very high-level committee that handles such diagnostic screening of the Public Health Service has been tackling this over the years, and about 2 years ago, maybe three now, they came out with a recommendation that PSAs need not be done, and especially in men 60 and older, or certainly 70 and older. And this was sort of a revolutionary approach. It put the primary care physician on the spot, because he or she has to explain all this to the patients, and by and large, understandably, patients want to have a test done. but not always realize what it then entails in terms of an elevated level.
Right. A lot of people really get alarmed, and and like you said, this can trigger, you know, okay, then we have to do testing, which means biopsies. And let's say there was a metastatic cancer, a biopsy can create metastasis. It can, and it can also create bleeding and other problems, right?
Yeah, the major complications would be bleeding and infection. It is controversial as to whether a biopsy spreads any cancer, but there are some case reports where that was clearly shown for lung cancer and things of that nature, perhaps breast cancer. But it's more the other. And the cost is very, very significant. And the interesting approach is that in other countries, Sweden, for example, they simply use watchful waiting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can give you an example. I had a very good friend who many, many years before had a simple prostatectomy because he had an enlarged prostate, and in the microscopic examination, there was just a little nest of cancer. His urologist decided just to leave it alone and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
10 or 12 years later, he developed a spread into his bones and was dead within a year. And therein lies the question, what makes the cancer, any cancer, change its behavior from something quiet, innocent, just sitting there, perhaps even trivial, to one that really takes off? And we just don't have that information. So that the molecular biologists are looking at this and trying to come up with a much more accurate, more specific, and sensitive test for prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what do you recommend in terms of, and you know, to your student, medical students, what would you recommend about PSA?
Well, I think the most important thing is to involve the patient in this whole discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And if at the end of it the patient is eager to move ahead and have the biopsy and whatnot, then the complications discussion of the costs and whatnot are the next step. I will say that our urologic colleagues still feel that prostate cancer must be treated with radical surgery,
mm-hmm.
by and large.
Yes, and it's interesting, like mammograms, screening for breast cancer, you know, often a mammogram is just a screen, and so it's similar in that then it leads to more and more invasive testing, and then a lot of times there are false positives, and it ends up with the waiting that women get really frightened, and it can cause a lot of stress.
Yes, yeah. We're more ahead now with breast cancer in terms of determining which types of breast cancer, which cellular,
right.
types, molecular types, are probably going to be a problem and need,
mm-hmm.
more aggressive treatment. So that's important. And now, recently, the big thing is the big advance is what to do with women who have very dense breasts.
Mm-hmm.
And it is difficult with mammograms.
Right.
So MRIs,
ultrasound,
stereoscopic examination is now being,
mm-hmm.
done instead,
mm-hmm.
of mammograms.
Right. And then the insurance companies, we're going to talk about insurance companies later, but they don't allow one of these tests before having a mammogram. They want the mammogram first. So that can, that's always an issue too.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay. So, so good. Well, you've been in practice for a number of years, and medicine has really changed in its trends. And let's just hear some of your experience and your reflections on experience.
Well, yeah, time doesn't permit compression of everything that I've observed over 50 plus years, but in this 1 hour, I'll try to hit some of the highlights. I think the public is aware of the advances in heart disease, cancer, arthritis, diabetes, kidney, lung, etc. There certainly are major, major advances.
You're talking about in terms of medical intervention.
Intervention and changing the...
Not necessarily in terms of health.
Changing the natural history of the disorder, if it's a bad outcome, to try to change the outcome into a more favorable outcome, prevent patients having morbidity or mortality. That we have certainly advanced. However, it has been extremely costly, and more so than any other country in the world, and our outcomes, unfortunately, are not any better in some instances, such as just an example with maternal mortality, infant mortality, and whatnot.
Yes, we have, I believe, on day within the first 24 hours, day one, we have the highest infant mortality of all the developed countries.
Yes, yes. As far as reflections, I would like to just mention some things that trends that I'm sorry are occurring in this country, such as the erosion of the doctor-patient relationship, probably in great part due to the fact that we are changing medicine to be a commodity. You know, like a ton of wheat or a ton of corn or whatever, to be regulated, price controlled, etc. And so doctors who are still practicing, many have retired prematurely, not wanting to put up with all the regulations and controversy and losing the art of medicine, have joined groups and joined hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have become employees and are marching to many different drummers, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the state and county and federal governments, etc. And so don't have a lot of time to take care of patients the way they really want to, because they have overhead and bills or they have to satisfy their employer. And so there is a tendency to have short visits and to order consultations with specialists and testing, laboratory, x-ray, MRIs, and diagnostic testing, rather than spending the time and listening to the patient and hearing what the patient says, looking at the patient, seeing what you look at, and coming up with a reasonable diagnosis and following the patients along.
It takes more time than 5 minutes to be able to do that.
Oh, yes, yes. And it's not necessary always to make every diagnosis right on that first visit. Take care of the things that may cause symptoms, undergo some palliation if need be, symptomatic treatment, and sooner or later the diagnosis will become clearer, even without some of the elegant testing. But by the same token, you know, x-rays and MRIs and CAT scans are only significant if they correlate with what you find on the patient clinically, both
right,
in terms of history and physical examination.
And that would be the same with lab tests as
well. And with lab tests, yeah.
Yeah. I once had a woman come into my office, and she was coming in because she had many miscarriages and she was trying to get pregnant. And her thyroid gland was, I could see across the room, was very much enlarged. And so I said to her, so did your previous doctor do a blood test and evaluate your thyroid? And she said, oh, yes. Everything was in normal range. Everything was fine. And so here's an example of this where you have a definite sign where you can see that the thyroid is very much enlarged and is having a problem, but the test is saying everything is fine. So I treated her for low thyroid, and she was able to get pregnant within 3 months and then to had a baby to term. and didn't have a miscarriage. So so that's just an example, one example of what you're talking about.
Well, there's many, many. My own field of arthritis and rheumatology. If we take x-rays on everybody who walks by the door, we're going to see wear and tear arthritis. We all have it. But it may not be what the patient has. The patient may have an inflammatory arthritis, which is very much more treatable.
So so doctors are really discouraged about being in private practice now. And that's part of the problem, because they aren't able to make enough money to sustain the practice. Is that right?
I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. Overhead goes up all the time, mm-hmm. and the reimbursement from the insurance companies goes down.
Right.
And one has to spend a lot of extra time, hire employees to deal with insurance companies, to get approval, pre-authorization, we call it, for testing, for procedures. It's very, very complicated. It's interesting that the trend among hospitals in this regard is to join together as a big network and to be self-insured, to set up their own insurance companies so they don't have to deal with an intermediary. That has its pros and cons, but seems to be an exciting trend.
Mm-hmm. So when the insurance company is the intermediary, as it is, then the doctor is working for the insurance company, not for the patient in many instances.
Well,
right?
The insurance company is working for itself. You know, it has to it has to speak to its shareholders. It's for profit. And everything is dictated by market medicine. And this is the trend, market mm-hmm. medicine. So that and it's become a numbers game, because doctors' performances no longer depends on the patient's outcome or the patient's satisfaction. It's certain numbers, artificial numbers, that the insurance companies can track, can test. For example, cholesterol levels in diabetics, a blood test, hemoglobin A1C, blood pressure readings, all of which are just numbers. They don't tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. Or how well the doctor treats his computer, his electronic medical record, more so than how he treats his patient. And mm-hmm. these are the standards. Well, many doctors just can't accept that, just a matter of principle. And leave practice. As far as primary care, our medical students are not choosing primary care. They have a lot of debt, $250,000, or sometimes $300,000 when they finish medical school, and so they're going into salaried positions, but staying away from primary care because of the not only the financial situation, but the control. And also the fact that if they want to raise a family, it's very difficult for their families.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about this, you know, fragmentation in terms of specialists, so many specialists, and what that causes.
Yes, that's not a good trend, the fragmentation of care. For example, if you have to be hospitalized, most hospitals now employ hospitalists who do only hospital medicine, and their own doctor is not permitted to be their primary care doctor in the hospital. He can make social visits and whatnot, and it's very laudable if they do, just to keep in touch so that when the patient's discharged, they'll have a handle on what happened at the hospital. Communication is an issue between the hospitalists and the primary care doctors. But if the patient needs rehab or a temporary nursing home or whatever, then it's another team of doctors. And this can go on, and maybe 5 or 6 months later, the patient may return to their primary care doctor, who may be completely in the dark about what transpired. But also, this engenders polypharmacy.
Right. So you have all of you have one patient who's been on medications from his or her primary care doctor. He's going into the hospital, getting more medications, then goes to another facility and gets more. And no one's looking at how they're all interacting.
Nobody subtracts. One only adds, and often find that patients are given two or three medications for the same condition. So that is also an issue. And then there are other things that are along with this. There's a very strong need and for confidentiality and privacy for patients and their records. And there's a HIPAA government agency that watches over this. But this can be a little too stringent. For example, I had a patient a couple of years ago who was not able to care for himself in terms of his medication, nor was his wife, but a single daughter who was an intensive care unit nurse, doled out the medications, took care of the daily needs. She lived with the family. Well, he had to have an operation. After the surgery, she asked the surgeon to bring her up to date. Did he change anything? Did he add anything? He said, I can't talk with you. HIPAA won't permit it. And she was beside herself, and she said, well, if I'm not up to date, something's going to happen to my dad. Well, I can't talk with you. So she called me, and I then got in touch with him, and in fact, he hadn't made any changes. But, you know, if one acts in good faith and acts as your patient's counsel, advocate, that is the most important goal. So that is another issue. You talked about insurance companies. I would like to mention that I was around in the mid-60s when Medicare first came in, and I was asked by my medical school dean to head up a hospital, a chronic disease hospital, and this was before Medicare. And I was quite chagrined and upset to find that there were two different buildings, two standards of care and nursing. One was for those who had private insurance or who could pay, and the other was for those who were on the Medicaid. In those days, it was welfare, it was called.
I'm sorry, when did you say that was?
That was in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And mid to late 60s, and it was very difficult for a young physician who's just kind of starting out to accept this from an ethical and moral point of view. Well, Medicare came along soon thereafter, and Medicare is, as you know, insurance for everybody over 65, and it leveled the playing field. We then switched to one standard of care.
Mm-hmm.
And that was absolutely breathtaking.
So, yeah, tell us what it was like with the two different parts of the hospital back then.
One part had registered nurses, piped in oxygen. The other and had regular hospital beds. Some were electric and some weren't in those days. But the other side, some of the patients had to lie in beds of hay.
Wow.
Sawdust, sometimes. No registered nurses, practical licensed nurses. No oxygen. We had to bring tanks in. It was very, very different. But that all changed with Medicare. And at that time, the organized medicine, the AMA, fought this tooth and nail.
They fought having
Medicare. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And this has changed now with Obamacare or the Accountable Care Act. Organized medicine has joined this effort, and that the future for that is still up in the air. It's very interesting. It's become a very political issue. Republicans are against and Democrats are for, but it's unfortunately people lose track of the fact that this is a social issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part of it is that people who are uninsured will be insured. We have some issue with costs and availability, access to care, but I just have to look back on the 60s and see what Medicare did. My my regret is that during this whole debate of Obamacare, there was not a good opportunity to talk about single payer, which would be like having Medicare for everybody. Government insurance, we would need private insurance companies.
Kind of like all the other developed countries have.
Yes.
They have care for their citizens. What a concept.
Yep.
Free even care.
Over the border in Canada. Yeah, they have that.
It mm-hmm. is a little past 12:30, and you're listening to Health Talk on the 2nd of March. Dr. Donna Kaplan and her dad, Dr. Hugh Kaplan. Always great having you on, Hugh.
Thank you.
Anytime.
And let's give folks the phone number in case they have a question or comment and want to call in.
826-7771 and 866-275-1114. I have a question.
Yes.
Prostate is prevention. Is there something you can do to prevent it, to control it? I was just wondering if you could touch upon that, please.
Good question. There's probably a hereditary factor in prostate enlargement, and there are rare situations where there is a very strong family history. Now, no question that anybody who has a parent or a brother or a grandfather who had prostate cancer should be screened with PSAs now, and when something new comes down the pike with a new test. But there is a major issue there with family history. But otherwise, no. I don't think there's anything that will prevent prostate from enlarging. It seems to reach a peak at about age 68, 70, and then regress in size. So men have to put up with a plumbing problem during those years. There was a study done in the Navy many years ago on an aircraft carrier where these are young men, and we're not talking about the enlargement of prostate that older men get, but just in terms of inflammation and infection. And for some reason, these men were fairly abstinent. They were abstinent in terms of female contact, heterosexual contact. But they were also otherwise abstinent, and they developed a lot of sludge type of problems, inflammation, infection, and of course with that the enlarged prostate. So there was a recommendation that if a man has regular sexual activity, stopping that for some reason is not good for the prostate, but a doctor can't write a prescription for that. At any rate, that would be about the only thing. And I think it's clear that some of the bicycle seats that the long-distance bike riders use could be modified a bit, and certainly the motorcyclists, but that's another behavior problem. I think for men who have a large prostate and have some difficulty urinating, it's very important if they're on a long trip that they stop as soon as they get the signal that they've got to urinate, and not say, I know there's a gas station in 10 miles, because
there won't be.
There won't be. And if the bladder stretches too much, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to get it going again, and you have to find a hospital to be catheterized. That's no fun.
Saw palmetto. That has always been thrown around as helping prostate problems. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Saw palmetto is more directing benign prostatic hypertrophy.
Okay.
And so it saw palmetto has phytohormones in them, which can be beneficial. Now, in terms of my practice as a holistic doctor, as a naturopathic doctor and Chinese medicine practitioner, in terms of inflamed prostate, definitely we're looking at, diet and exercise and stress levels and everything that can, and environmental toxins, everything that is going to contribute to inflammation in the body. And then often that can be changed just by changing the diet, changing food sensitivities, or addressing imbalances in the colon, for example, which can lead to leaky gut syndrome. But that's that would be for inflamed or infection. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for all that great information.
We have a caller?
We do. Good afternoon. Hello, good afternoon.
So, okay.
He'll call back.
Okay, very good. So, tell us, do you have anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I might just say a word, a couple of things more. The situation with hospitals merging and creating these very large systems is somewhat of a concern. And we're talking about most hospitals are not-for-profit hospitals. There are some for-profit organizations that one arm of which is a hospital, and they're very different. In Massachusetts, we have several that have come in, and they, of course, like any profit organization, have to show profit. But I think it's important to remember that nonprofit hospitals were one time called charity hospitals or charitable hospitals when people didn't have insurance. Free care was important. Other activities in the community was important. A few years ago, during the Iraqi war and then the Afghan war, I decided that we needed civilian care to supplement what the military is doing, and the VA particularly is doing, for our wounded coming back. And I thought that that hospitals should play a role in this. I had the support of organized medicine, both my medical society in Massachusetts and the American Medical Association, and individuals, doctors, therapists, naturopaths, nurses, they were all happy to join in. We could not, however, get the hospitals to support this. Their answer was, there were several, but for example, our war is in the emergency room. Let the federal people take care of these wounded coming back. And I would say, look, we're at war. These people are sacrificing themselves. We have an obligation. And you particularly have an obligation, you charitable hospital, because you're getting all sorts of benefits, tax-exempt loans, all sorts of benefits for your charitable status. What are you doing these days to justify the charitable status? And this has become an issue not necessarily related to the civilian care for the wounded, but in other areas. Hospitals, while they are on paper non-profit, many of them are more like for-profit organizations.
Even though they're calling themselves nonprofit.
Nonprofit.
Right?
So I think we have to keep at them with this. They must justify their nonprofit charitable status. So another trend that
I just want to say one thing.
Sure.
And unfortunately, when you have this in the system where an entity like a hospital has to make a profit, then the decisions that are being made are for money, not for necessarily the care of the patient. So.
Absolutely. And as part of Obamacare, the type of care delivered is changing. And maybe this is a good thing. Rather than a fee for service, the more things you do, the more fees you get from the insurance companies. This is changing to a global system. So for each disorder, there will be a budget and a certain amount of money that's allocated by a committee of non-professional people. That's a concern. But at least your primary care doctor, your surgeon, your hospital, your physical therapist, your nursing home will all be allocated a certain amount of money depending on the diagnosis. So a gallbladder operation will be one thing. A heart attack might be another. And this will be a big change, and it's impacting the hospitals already. already, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they were paid by a per diem method, pretty mm-hmm. much.
And we have a caller. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Aloha.
Yes, Dr. Donna, I wanted to say that it makes me sad to think that our friends in Europe have a cradle-to-grave single-payer system where the administrative cost for the health coverage and health care runs 3-4%. In America, because we have this great belief in the private great enterprise system, our administrative costs run at least 30-40%. So if we would adopt the European model of socialized medic, God forbid, that we could take all that money we spend on business, you know, and spend it on care.
What a concept.
Yeah, and so I don't think that will ever happen when there are people who have this weird understanding of what America is about. And I don't think that is exactly Pono. But anyway, I wanted to follow Cousin Rich's line of questioning. I'm a health nut, and the two books I've recently been impressed with were the Okinawan study and the China study. Now, the Okinawan study indicated that, for example, the men in Japan and the women in Japan, because they eat high soy content, they have the lowest incidence of breast cancer and prostate cancer.
Yeah, I always look at, okay, is it really because of the high soy content? I don't know that there's proof, but they're seeing, okay, well, there's that difference between that population and the American population. But they also eat a lot of fish that have, you know, good fatty acids in them. So,
Dr. Kurt Weill mm-hmm. talks on this subject in his book on aging. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this subject that you're asking. And so if you want to look at that book, he gives a lot of great information about their social life, their diet, and there's a lot to be learned. So
I've read that.
But, yeah, good.
But the thing is,
important question.
The greatest mm-hmm. correlation I think they found is that the Okinawans have amongst the lowest cancer and prostate rates because they have the highest flavonoid intake. They have 50 times the flavonoid intake as Okinawans living in Canada or the U.S. and other Westerners. Mm-hmm. So that is, I guess, the main. And then there's also the correlation, the argument that the low saturated fat is responsible for the lower breast and prostate cancer.
Hmm.
But, you know, I take the salt palmetto, I take the pumpkin seed oil, I take the sting nettle, and I watch out for big trucks.
Good for you.
Thanks,
good
guys.
For you. Well, alrighty. I think those bring up, you know, important considerations, and it all points to having a good diet with, you know, flavonoid-rich diet. We're talking about lots of vegetables and also fruits and good beneficial fats and proteins. And getting rid of junk food and so much sugar in the diet.
And the thing with pumpkin seed is they're real high in zinc, and that's one of the
they
reasons.
Are.
Yeah.
That is very good for the prostate.
Uh-huh. Thank you,
thanks a lot for the call.
We should also point out that you mentioned the Japanese. They have a very high incidence of cancer of the esophagus and stomach. And we used to have a high incidence of cancer of the stomach in the 40s and 50s and maybe early 60s, and it's kind of faded away.
To what do you attribute that to?
In males particularly, and supplemented now by lung and prostate.
And also pancreatic.
And now right. we're seeing more and more pancreatic cancer, mm-hmm. yes. You know, so this, I myself believe that there's got to be a perhaps racial and genetic factor that we haven't yet identified in some of these populations.
Thank you, doctors.
All righty. You have a good afternoon.
I wanted to also say a word, perhaps from an educational point of view, that there's an awful lot on the Internet, and invariably patients are already self-diagnosed when they get in touch with their health practitioner, and invariably they're wrong. for whatever reason, either what they've read or the associations and conclusions that they make. So don't try not to get into that trap. And also, you know, we doctors are learning all the time, and I tell my students, your best teachers are your patients. And so be sure to fess up and don't hold anything back from your doctor. But also, we learn from our patients after they pass on. And I'm talking about the value of an autopsy. And this is something that has changed considerably. It used to be, a 30% figure, at least in the high 20s in this country, most communities, community hospitals. And now it's virtually non-existent. It's almost down to zero. And I think there are many reasons for that. I think that we get lulled into a false sense of security with MRIs and CAT scans and maybe think that we know it all because of the testing that we do. Well, studies have shown that 40% of autopsies turn up diagnoses that were missed, and a good number of these are actually primary diagnoses, primary causes of death. And I think now we owe it to the patient's families to request permission to do an autopsy, because we have so much more information now about genetics and genetic medicine, the human genome. And it saddens me when patients ask their doctors if they cannot have an autopsy done on their beloved mother or father or whomever, and the doctor says, oh, no, we know everything about your mother's death. And in fact, we don't. And so, and sometimes even the funeral directors discourage an autopsy. So keep that in mind, because once things are over, and especially if there's a cremation, it's very, very difficult to get information. So often patients will call and say, Dr. Kaplan, my mother died 2 or 3 months ago. What did she actually die of? She was 90 years old. She had Alzheimer's. What did she die of? And in that case, we can say it was the Alzheimer's, and the urinary infection was not a primary cause of death. But very often we don't know, and we say, well, you know, we asked for an autopsy, but you refused it. And it doesn't have to be a total autopsy. You know, it can be limited to the chest, to a single organ like the heart, limited to the abdomen. I mentioned Alzheimer's. Certainly that's become an epidemic, and we know so little about it, because without actually examining the brain tissue, we really can't understand what it's all about. So self-diagnosis, autopsies, if your doctor doesn't bring it up, ask for it if you're interested.
I just want to say about information on the internet, I think that it can be very beneficial for people to be able to read about their condition. And I agree with you, you know, it's important not to make a self-diagnosis, but you can say, well, I could have this, or this. Let me go seek advice. But the internet can be very beneficial. And also, you know, of course, there is a lot of false information out there. And the more you read, the more you think you have.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, it's a tool, and you take it for what it's worth.
Right.
Another trend that we might want to mention is the minute clinics and pharmacies. Mm-hmm. I don't know how prevalent they are here, but they're very prevalent in the Northeast. Pharmacies have looked upon their stores as convenience stores. You come in for whatever and see the nurse practitioner. While you're there, you buy cosmetics and groceries and whatever else is available. But they have now changed to, in many areas, to become wellness clinics, to take the place of needing to see your health practitioner for symptoms, but more so for health physicals. And there's been a lot written about annual physicals. There was an editorial in the New York Times pointing out a couple of months ago that they were not cost-effective, they were not suitable to pick up diseases that may be lurking and not obvious at this time. I look upon annual physicals as a time for the doctor and the patient to get together, and this may be very important. Whether it's worth the cost or not is another issue. But what concerns me is the unintended consequences. If you've just had a physical and you were told everything is fine, I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, and then you develop some new chest pain, and you say, well, I just had my physical, I had a cardiogram, my doctor said everything is fine.
Yeah, I'm fine. I just had a great physical.
Yeah. Or if you have a physical coming up in a month or two, something already scheduled, oh, my chest pain can wait for that physical. So there is this new issue of whether they are cost-effective and whether they are effective in turning up information, but there's also these unintended consequences.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point to realize, that if someone has a physical, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, even if everything came out okay on a blood test and the physical exam, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything is fine. So not to avoid signs or symptoms that the body is trying to tell you.
Exactly.
And we have another caller. Good afternoon.
Aloha.
Good afternoon.
Aloha. How are you?
Aloha.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, we're here.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's okay.
Thanks for the program. I was traveling in my car and just happened to hear about autopsies. So I have a question. I'm an organ donor. I have that on my, you know, driver's license. So how does that work with having an autopsy done?
Well, that it depends on the state and how the regulations were written. In my own state of Massachusetts, that trumps an autopsy.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, that, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a very, very important situation, that we need organs. There's certainly not enough livers and kidneys and hearts, especially, and at least in Massachusetts, that trumps. You can work, however, you know, have the organ, whatever organ is to be transplanted, done, and then work with the with your doctor and the hospital, and if it is a hospital situation, and then perform the autopsy afterwards. And it can be a very limited autopsy. If, however, that particular organ was the cause of death, it would not be suitable for a transplant anyway, so...
Right. Usually in that situation with organs being donated, that happens like with a death from a car accident or some kind of car accident, right?
Well, that would be many organs from a young person.
Right.
But we often, like in Massachusetts, you can have on your driver's license, I am an organ donor. And yet, if it's not a motor vehicle accident, but a hospital situation, that is illegal. That has to first be dealt with.
Okay, first dealt with the organ donation. So I have that on my driver's license for the state, Hawaii. So if I was, that brings up another question for me, is autopsies being beneficial for my children to learn more about my health and what may have affected me and be of concern to them if, you know, it was, has a potential to affect their health in the future. So anyway, it just brings up more things for me, but autopsy versus organ donors.
In terms of your choice, you mean?
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, but you're saying that, what I hear you saying is that I could, I could have control on them just taking a particular organ if it's in good health. And what are the chances of, you know, the health of that organ? I imagine it deteriorates, you know, the older I get, or et cetera, that type of thing.
Yes, well, that's always an issue.
Yeah.
And that can be determined by the I don't know the situation here in Hawaii, but in Massachusetts, that can be determined in a, let's say, a conference with the hospital pathologist and your doctor, and very often a decision is made, well, we can't use that that kidney if it is a kidney. One reason that this has to be legalized ahead of time is, for example, in Massachusetts, once you pass on, you no longer have control.
Right.
And
right.
You can tell the doctor, oh, I want to have an autopsy when I'm done, when I'm gone, because I want to help my family and this and that. But there can be a dispute among the siblings in saying,
right.
Oh, mother has suffered enough, you know, and we... And unfortunately, mother has nothing to say at that point
right.
in Massachusetts. I don't know about Hawaii, but so it's very important, and it's very difficult for the doctors too. Unfortunately, if you wait and discuss this with the family after the demise occurs, everybody is emotionally upset. The doctor is upset. The family is upset. What I tell my colleagues is there's always an opportunity, a few days or a week, when you know that the patient is going to pass, and you tell the family, either in person or by phone or whatever, get your family together, make your arrangements, because mother is not going to live. That's the time when you talk about contacting your attorney, your family, or this and that. That's the time. Also, think about an autopsy at that point. Discuss it with your siblings, with your children. That's when things are relatively quiet emotionally. Don't wait until the very end. And it's very difficult for doctors. We in my hospital, we actually have training sessions for this to help them. And again, it doesn't have to be a total autopsy. It can be very limited
mm-hmm.
to any part of the body. And it's done in a very professional way. It doesn't interfere with the funeral at all. It doesn't delay it. But it's a golden opportunity to pass on information, both to the family and to the doctor.
Well, we have run out of time. Thank you for that great call.
You're welcome.
Okay, you have a good day.
Aloha.
Well, Dr. Kaplan and Ray over there, I wish you a wonderful spring. The same to you, Donna. You'll be leaving us next week, huh?
Be leaving this week, Saturday. Yeah.
Will you have a most wonderful trip and a healthy trip?
We shall return.
Good.
Yay. Well, thank you so much. This session brought up so many important considerations. And very excellent show.
Thank you.
And
for
up next,
me.
My good friend Richard with One World Radio. Okay, you and Ray, go well.
Ahui ho.
When morning comes to Morgantown, the merchants roll their awnings down. The milk trucks make their morning rounds in morning Morgantown. We'll rise up early with the sun to ride the bus while everyone is yawning and the day is young. No.